Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 3rd, 2017. The head of the UN peacekeepers tells President Kiir and First Vice President Taban Deng Gai to end fighting in South Sudan.
In spite of the unilateral ceasefire, the fightings are continuing in different areas of the country, and it's a matter of concern because the continuation of fighting is an obstacle to further progress in the political track.
And several traders have been arrested in Juba during a crackdown.
The first arrest was 9 suspects. We got them with 170 jerrycans of fuel. And then they were actually smuggling it into the town in the Nisitu area.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The spokesman of South Sudan police says the death toll from yesterday's attack on two buses traveling from Nimule to Juba has risen. Daniel Justin Achor says 10 people were wounded and 9 others were killed.
Two of them are soldiers and 7 civilians. Yes, this is the final report of today. And all those who were wounded are taken to Numile, and now the situation is calm.
Achor says buses left from Juba to Numile today without any incidents. He says many passengers ran into the bush during Wednesday's morning attack.
They started to report back one by one. So it was really very hard to us to get exactly the figure of those who are wounded and missing and so on.
He says all of the people who were reported as missing have since arrived safely in Nimule town. South Sudan's military spokesman, Brigadier General Lul Roy Kong, blamed rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar for attacking buses and other vehicles along the Juba-Nimule road. The deputy military spokesman for SPLM-IO, Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, denies his forces are responsible and says his team will investigate the incident. Government officials have promised to increase the number of security agents escorting convoys traveling along the Juba-Nimule road. A top United Nations official is calling on the leaders of South Sudan's warring parties to end the cycle of violence and engage in a political process to resolve their differences. The head of the UN peacekeeping operations, Jean-Pierre Lacrosse, visited Juba and Abyei this week. He told reporters today in Juba that continued fighting in South Sudan has affected the entire population of the country. Waki Simon Wudu has details for VOA from Juba.
Jean-Pierre Lacroix arrived in Juba on Tuesday to assess security and meet with the South Sudan's leaders, including President Salva Kiir. At today's news conference in Juba, Lacroix said both parties to the conflict seem to be reluctant to ending the ongoing fighting.
In spite of the unilateral ceasefire that was decided by the authorities, fightings are continuing in different areas of the country, and it's certainly a matter of concern. It's a matter of concern because the continuation of fighting is certainly an obstacle to further progress in the political track, and it's also a matter of concern because these fightings obviously have a very serious impact on the population.
Lacroix says the fighting has displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians from their homes, worsening the humanitarian situation in the country.
This is a situation that remains quite serious. The UN as a whole, UNMISS and the agencies and those who work with them are doing their best to help as many people as possible, and doing it in very difficult situations, very, very difficult and sometimes dangerous conditions.
This is Lacroix's second visit to Juba. He says he met with President Kiir, First Vice President Taban Deng Gai, and other officials to press them to restore peace and stability in the country, revitalize the 2015 peace agreement, and to deploy the Regional Protection Force. Lakwa says 150 peacekeepers from Bangladesh have been deployed in recent months as part of the Regional Protection Force aimed at protecting major installations across the country, including Juba International Airport.
The deployment of RPF is, as you know, ongoing. It has been probably slower than all of us would have hoped for, but things are now accelerating, which is a good thing. A number of units have already been deployed in Juba. A number of other units will be deploying soon in the coming months.
Lakwa says the UN is making every possible effort to expedite the process. He says the UN plans to deploy 4 battalions in the coming months from Rwanda to boost security in the country. Lakwa also visited Malakal, capital of the former Upper Nile state, one of several areas that has seen stepped-up fighting over the past years. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A committee formed last week to crack down on illegal fuel dealers in Juba says it has arrested more than 10 traders who are selling fuel in a black market. A police spokesman says the suspects will be tried in a court of law and may face stiff penalties if found guilty. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan National Police spokesman Daniel Justin Achor says most of the suspects are under police custody, while others were bailed out by relatives as they await formal charges. Achor also says police are keeping 5,000 liters of confiscated fuel at the police headquarters in Buluk, which will be presented as evidence when the suspects are arraigned.
The first arrest was 9 suspects. We got them with 170 jerrycans of fuel. Then they were actually smuggling it into the town in the Nisitu area. In the city, the operation was very small quantities.
The suspects will be tried at Juba City Council Court in Kator. They face fines or imprisonment for up to 6 months. Achor says fines and prison sentences will be based on the quantity of fuel found in each suspect's possession. The state-owned Nile Petroleum Corporation is already distributing fuel to scores of filling stations around Juba, according to Achor.
Now we have more than 10 petrol stations operating right now when I'm talking. And another problem is our people. Everybody wants to be the first. People don't like to line up.
A resident of Juba's Gudele neighborhood, who prefers to be identified only as John for safety reasons, says the crackdown has only worsened the fuel shortages, forcing many motorists to park their vehicles.
Individuals know where it is. It is not easy now getting it. It has worsened, and he said it has increased the price, even double the price, or even 3 times. Mm-hmm. It has not gained any other good thing that we see.
John says he has been forced to park his motorbike and struggles every day to find a public transport to get to work. Stephen Bonju, who resides in Juba's Tijaria neighborhood, works as a driver for a local investment company, welcomes the crackdown on the black market fuel sellers. Speaking in Arabic, Bonju is urging the government to ensure a steady supply of the fuel station in Juba and across the country.
We hope that our government will increase the fuel in many stations. As we have seen this week, many stations are now operational. We need to see all of them functioning.
Achor says the way most black market sellers store fuel is very dangerous, since petrol and diesel are extremely flammable. He advised them to get into another line of business.
There are people selling these groundnuts, selling cake, selling water. That one is safer, and then you will earn income.
Achor warns that President Kiir's committee will continue its crackdown on black market fuel sellers until prices have returned to normal and the fuel crisis is resolved. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
South Sudanese analysts say the government should use $44 million donation from the African Development Bank to reduce food shortages in the country. A policy analyst with the Juba-based Sudan Institute says the government should find a long-term solution to the country's economic problems. Nabil Biagio has the story for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Finance and Economic Planning Minister Stephen Dio Dow said this week he signed the $43.8 million grant agreement with the African Development Bank. Dow said in a statement the money will also be used to boost the country's economic growth. Augustino Tinmayai, a policy analyst at the Juba-based SET Institute, says the government's first priority should be to provide life-saving assistance to IDPs and to people suffering from war and hunger.
As the country now undergoes humanitarian crisis, by the end of the day, saving lives is going to be the most important one. I don't really think that you can enhance economic growth with that kind of money. It's not much, especially if you are trying to pay for medical services, as well as trying to provide food for those that are displaced by the war, as well as climate-related events.
Mayai says it's impossible to achieve economic growth while war is still rages across the country.
End the war. That's going to help. Once there is no war, we're not shooting at each other, we can think more appropriately in terms of economic growth, in terms of our stakes in having that economic growth, we can produce more, we can learn more technologies and use them to develop our economy. It's just going to be the end of war. That's going to turn things around and allow recovery of the economy.
Ahmed Morjan, a professor of economics at the University of Juba, says the government must make sure the grant is used to help the South Sudanese people and does not end up in the pockets of corrupt politicians.
If these grants are directed towards the objectives, then it will be positively received by the people of South Sudan. In other words, the beneficiaries will have to benefit from the grants. Otherwise, if the money is misallocated, then I'm afraid this money is supposed to go towards will never benefit from it.
Edmund Yakani, executive director of the Juba-based Community Empowerment for Progress organization, agrees with Morjan.
The two best ways to use it effectively is make it as a conditional grant for the states or make it as a call for projects and where national NGOs that have capability can apply and implement projects under that particular grant so that at least check and balance is effective.
Morjan says while grants can help with emergency assistance, South Sudan needs a long-term solution to its economic and humanitarian crisis.
An economy should not totally depend on grants or loans. For any stability in the economy, what we need foremost is there should be peace and security.
Once peace is finally restored, Morjan says, economic sectors such as agriculture, mining, and the oil industry can be revived in order to grow the economy. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at elections in Rwanda and Kenya. Those stories are coming next after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What core value do you live by?
I do value my education a lot because I know that with education I can go anywhere. I can explore the world. I can be whoever I want to be. I can go anywhere. I can do anything I want in life.
I live by the hard working as the core value and prioritizing the priorities. I like it just because when I live in hard working, I know for sure one day I might achieve something which I need in life.
It's respect. I love to be respected and I love to respect other people.
Okay, trust. So I love like someone I can trust. So I want someone to trust me because that's the way to go. Because if you don't trust someone, then there's nothing, there's no one you can go for either.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. 10 years after Kenya's post-election violence that left more than 1,000 people dead, a new report has been released on the status of security and justice in the country. The report is a joint effort by the International Federation for Human Rights in Paris and the Kenyan Human Rights Commission. It's entitled Kenya's Scorecard on Security and Justice, Broken Promises and Unfinished Business. George Kegoro is the executive director of the commission. From Nairobi, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the status of security reforms in Kenya.
It's negative. We've had challenges about terrorism. and terrorist-related threats, and then the responses that we've made to those threats. So we have the problem of insecurity from terrorism that we have not managed to completely address. And then when we also deal with that, we deal with it in a manner that itself undermines human rights in counterterrorism measures.
Would you explain further in that regard, what measures do you feel are violating human rights in the war against terrorists?
We have had levels of profiling of people based on religion, based on physical appearance. The worst aspects of that happened in 2015 with the operation that was carried in Nairobi, where members of the Somali community were bussed into a stadium and put through a security screening, and the basis on which that happened was entirely their physical appearance. But that has not ended there, because we've had in the recent past security operations in the northeastern part of the country, which is the Kenyan-Somali neighborhoods, where again we've had mass graves that have not been explained so clearly. The security agents are active in that part of the country. There are killings going on, and we don't know the basis on which those killings are going on. And then, of course, the fact that people are then buried in mass graves means that there is an attempt to cover up the fact that the killings have happened in the first place.
Now, of course, you began your work following the 2007-2008 post-election violence. Have you seen any improvements in regards to preventing such violence in the upcoming election?
This election is a replica of the 2007 election. We have got an incumbent versus a challenger situation. Every time we've had an incumbent versus a challenger situation in Kenya's recent electoral history, we've had some violence emanating from just that situation. Secondly, we have a very polarized political context in which all sides of the political divide, the main sides of the political actors in this country, have got very strongly entrenched positions against each other. But in addition to that, you've got a significant amount of belligerence that has been coming from the government side in relation to the campaigns that they've carried out recently. That is completely unusual. In Kenya's electoral history, the government has not been this belligerent in campaigns. This particular election is remarkable because of levels of belligerence that they've shown in the way they interact with the population in the campaigns. And that is something that worries. That is also something that shows that somewhere down the line, this campaign has stopped being a democratic exercise where one or the other party can win and the opposite party losing, and has become very much a power struggle. It feels as though the government side is no longer interested in winning an election. It is more interested in retaining power. So this is what this campaign boils down to in the recent 2 to 5 days.
What would you like to see happen between now and Election Day to help prevent any violence?
To leave the Electoral Commission alone. They've had the death that happened against a key official that is in charge of the preparations. Chris Msando was the ICT director. We would like assurances that the commission is safe and is not going to be the subject of political pressure that seeks to undermine the results one way or the other. So we would like an assurance that it is still an electoral contest rather than a power struggle between the two sides. And that is something that can only come from the president's side, showing that they're interested in an election rather than in retaining power at all costs.
Now, the report also looks at reforms in the judiciary sector. How much progress has been made there?
It's been many steps forward, a few steps back, so it's a mixed picture.
George Kigoro is the executive director of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission. From Nairobi, he spoke to VOA's Jordi Kapwa. The people of Rwanda go to the polls on Friday for analysis of tomorrow's presidential election. Reporter Claude Kabengera in Kigali spoke with political analyst Christopher Kayumba, a researcher and an educator at the University of Rwanda. Kayumba speaks about the main issues the country faces and how they might influence the polls.
From what I have heard from candidates, I would divide what they consider to be important issues into 3 points. One is economic, the other is social welfare, and finally, democracy and rights. If you look at RPF, President Kagame is emphasizing job creation, investing in industries, infrastructure, and ensuring social welfare. On the other hand, his opponents are largely emphasizing cutting taxes. Secondly, both the Green Party candidate, Frank, and Mahimana are largely focusing on sustaining democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of association, and media freedom. But they're also talking about investing in security. And of course, one of the main problems I have found with all the presidential candidates is their lack of defining the key challenges the country faces. Even when they talk about poverty, what does poverty mean in Rwanda's context?
Do you think the opposition members have a chance of making gains?
I don't think the opposition, the two candidates, have the capacity to make gains. I don't think any of them will get more than 2% because of the way they have articulated the issues, the way they have organized these elections. They are little known in the political scene, but also because of their campaign strategies.
What do you think are the chances of success for the one authorized opposition party in Rwanda, the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda?
Whether or not the Green Party becomes the main opposition party is difficult to decide, because if you look at how power is structured at the moment, we would say that PSD would be the largest political party because it has the second majority in parliament. PL is the third majority in parliament. The only way the Green Party can be considered a major political party, it will be after the next year's parliamentary elections. That is when we can know its strength. But before that happens, we can't know.
Do you think the campaigning has so far been fair and transparent?
From everything I have seen, 3 things have happened. This time round, because candidates have been allowed to express themselves, have been also allowed to access the media, and their complaints have also been responded to by the Electoral Commission and local leaders, there is no way anybody can say that they haven't been given the chance to express themselves.
Presidential challengers Frank Habineza and Philippe Mahiman are both younger players on the political scene. Do they either look like they will pose a serious challenge to President Kagame?
There is no way. If we compare the people who have been to their campaigns, they are too few to tell us that they can in any way significantly affect the electoral outcome. Secondly, their articulation of the issues and how they suggest solving these challenges. But the way they have done this also leaves a lot to be desired. I wouldn't say that any of the opponents of the incumbent will get even more than 2%.
Do you see Rwanda evolving in the future to a multi-party state?
You know, because of the structure of the political system, and because there is also a forum for political parties, Rwanda is not a majoritarian electoral system. Where political parties are sharing power, you don't have that kind of adversarial. So I don't see that in the next 10 to 20 years, Rwanda will have a vocal opposition political party, because this is not what is in the constitution, but it is also something that the political elite do not want.
You have profound background in media. Do you feel that media is properly empowered by law to look at the issues and cover the elections well? Or are there impediments to covering the political scene?
If you look at the Constitution, Article 34, it empowers the media. If the electoral law, it empowers the media. If you look at the media law of 2013, even access to information law, all these laws empower the media. So the challenge with the media are not located in law, not even in the number of media outlets. The challenge have to do with the capacity of media outlets, both intellectual capacity, but also financial abilities. Being able to cover all the candidates is very expensive, but also the ability to analyze these manifestos, what candidates are talking in terms of the nature of the economy and the nature of development is not something that is easy.
That's political analyst Christopher Kayumba. He spoke with reporter Claude Kabengera in Kigali. 14 South Sudanese professionals are among 1,000 Mandela Washington Fellows who are in the United States to study for 6 weeks. Ayen Bior spoke with one fellow who says he was impressed by the sense of community in his host city.
Arizona is a southwestern U.S. state well known for the Grand Canyon and desert landscapes, hot summers, and mild winters in its capital, Phoenix. That's where Mandela Washington fellow Simon Marut Tulong has spent the last 6 weeks.
Having been to a state that is really so dry and semi-desert, so it gave me like the feeling that we can do more as South Sudanese because we have everything. We have the Nile passing through our state. We have the sunshine, which is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I feel that for us not to be in darkness again, we just need around 250 megawatt of thermal energy in South Sudan, which can really run and serve a lot of communities in South Sudan.
Marut is a petroleum scientist by training and program manager for African Youth Network. The annual fellowship took him to Arizona State University, where he focused on civic leadership. Marut says he learned a few things about society while studying in Arizona.
Because even if you find a policeman, he talks with a lot of passion, with a lot of love for his or her job. So like in South Sudan, people are running away from the police forces to go and join the army because they feel like being a police is something that is of less privilege.
Marut says what really impressed him was a sense of community and love of country shared by the Americans he met. But mainly, he says, being a responsible citizen is an idea that is taught from an early age.
In high schools and in the lower levels, kids are taught the basics of being a citizen. What does it take for you to be a citizen of America? What does it take for you to be a citizen? And then what are your responsibilities as a citizen of America? So these are the small things that people don't look. We tend to overlook at some of these small things, and yet they really what made America a country that is loved by her citizen.
Marut is convinced that the solution to relentless fighting in South Sudan will come from ordinary, hardworking citizens, not the politicians.
Because people have only been solving political issues. Like those are the grievances among the political leaders, which are just like loose, tight ropes, which don't really make any sense. So for us to have a sustainable peace, we have to start it from the ground, and we have to start it with the young people who are really taught at their homes by their mothers and their fathers that a nearby tribe is an enemy. So for us to come together as a country, we need to bring these young people together. We don't need to have different tribes studying in different schools or praying in different churches. These are the things that are killing South Sudan.
Marut is one of 14 South Sudanese fellows participating in the Mandela Washington Fellowship. The fellowship is a U.S. government program that brings young Africans to the United States to study in different fields while highlighting academia, leadership training, and networking. Ayan Buer for VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Nyan Thin Wanjok by Aleu Bol Deng. We have been listening to Aleu Bol Deng with the song Nyan Thin Wanjok. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Would like your feedback on our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.